This is Wes Cunningham on November 18th in Gottschalk Hall with Ken Clay. Ken, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, your biographical information, if you were born in Louisville, if not, how you ended up here?
I was born in Louisville, born in number 13 College Court, which is a housing project here in the city. And I grew up here and have lived here all of my life. Have gone out of the area for visits and business trips, etc., and vacations. But basically, this is home for me, Louisville, Kentucky.
Can you tell me how you first got involved in art locally?
Whoa, how far back do you want me to go with that?
as far as you're willing to.
Of course, as a youngster going to church, you know, my brother and I sang in the children's choir, I guess you'd call it at that time. But my brother and I just loved to sing, and we eventually formed quartets as we were growing up. So we would be in different quartets, and we would like compete at different events and on different venues in the community. That was something that we both enjoyed very, very much. As I was growing up, and I'll skip over to the high school, because in high school I was in a choir and a group at Central High called the Les Chanteurs.
This is
L-E-C-H-A-N-T-E-U-R-E-S. This was a group of young men that had, this group had been at Central for years, so it was a tradition for this group to exist. And I and my brother and a few other guys that I sang with joined the Les Chanteurs. We sang classical music, we sang Negro spirituals, basically. You know, and we would perform at events at the school and out of the school. There was a teacher by the name of Ms. Crooms that directed the whole thing, a music teacher directed the whole thing. And often she would get calls from people outside of the school to bring a group out to an event to sing, etc. And we would be that group, most likely. There was also a girls group, I can't forget this. There was a group called Denals, D-E-N-A-L-L-E-S. So these were the two top groups, one female, one male, at Central High School. While there, I appeared in a number of presentations, the operetta. We did Porgy and Bess. I played some key roles in that. One thing that I will always remember is that Mrs. Crooms, our music teacher, got Maurice Mozart, right? Baumhart, you know, the Baumhart Theater at the Kentucky mm-hmm. City, Maurice Baumhart, to come and run us through our paces for an event that we were planning, you know. And that was the first time I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Baumhart. Ironically, later on in my career, I did meet Mr. Baumhart, and we exchanged some information regarding that and many other kinds of things that we experienced. What else? And musically, I kind of got away from singing, you know, but I began to get more into the production management side of doing things. So I found myself putting events together in the community, you know. I formed an organization, I co-founded an organization with a guy by the name of Clayton Duhaney, a very good friend of mine, who lived in the Washington, D.C. area. He transferred down to Louisville, and I hired him at the Urban League. I was working at the Urban League at that time. We worked there for about 10 years, and then I worked there for about 10 years, and we kind of broke off, formed our own organization called Renaissance, Renaissance Development Corporation. We had put together a number of different programs, one in housing, one in employment, one in economic development, and one in the arts. And as we went out to try to get support and money for these programs, ironically, the thing that really caught on was the arts. I know we went to Brown Foreman, and they loved the arts component that we came up with. So they gave us, at that time, a significant amount of money to get things rolling. They supported us very handsomely, we thought. So we began to do arts in the community and parks and community centers and things of that nature. We bring artists into those communities, you know. We bring artists there to teach young people and expose young people to the arts. So that's kind of the way I really got moving in the direction that I had proceeded, you know.
What year was this when y'all formed the Renaissance?
Had to be in the mid-70s. Yeah, I think somewhere in the mid-70s. I have to go back and look at my resume to see where dates were. Mm-hmm. Things begin to run together when you get older. I think.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Can you tell me a little bit about the positive or what kind of effect that these art programs had on, you know, some of the youth and the communities around there?
Yeah, it had a very, very positive effect. Under Renaissance, we formed a community dance company. There were a number of art exhibits that we coordinated and sponsored. We worked with artists such as G.C. Cox and Ed Hamilton, you know, to help them with putting on exhibits for them. And we did all the management and promotion and the presenting aspect of it. We brought in dance companies from Chicago, and with our company, which was named the Life Rhythm Dancers, Judith Jamison, who was with the Alan Ailey Company at the time, she came in to do a solo performance on us, and we rented out the Memorial Auditorium and just did a big dance event featuring all three of the companies, you know. So we began to get into presenting, making the arts known on a local level to people, you know. It was more of a classic dance, you know, as opposed to what was going on within the community. So we were exposing young people to maybe a different form of dance. So in that respect, I think it was quite beneficial.
And did you all focus, or was the organization mostly African American at the time? And what were the communities that you all were kind of...
We dealt with mostly inner city communities. We dealt with Park Hill. We dealt with Smoketown area, you know. So we dealt with inner city communities. We did go out to Newburgh on a couple of occasions, you know. But basically, we dealt with black communities. The dance company was, however, more of an integrated company, you know, modern dance, you know, type thing. It was more of an integrated group. That performed and gave instructions to the people in the youth in the community.
Can you tell me a little bit about the local art community outside of Renaissance? I know that I spoke to Bob Douglas and others who were part of, and G.C. Cox, who were part of, you know, the Louisville Art Workshop. Did you all collaborate with them quite a bit?
The art workshop actually was a little ahead of Renaissance. I knew everybody in the art workshop, and there might have been on occasion we maybe have coordinated. I can't be specific about any event we did, but we certainly had a very positive, working together relationship. Like you mentioned, G.C. Cox, I remember that we put together an exhibit down at a place called the Fig Tree, which is at 3rd and Broadway at the time, and we had G.C.'s works all in there, you know, for an event. So we were working, if not with the organization itself, certainly with individual artists, a part of the Art Artist Workshop.
Did you see local African American art kind of playing a role in the civil rights movement in Louisville, or the, you know, the Black freedom struggle that was going on at the time? Did you see art as kind of a forum to benefit African American culture and?
I think the arts, black art, I'll put it that way, nationally served to undergird the movement. The music that came out of the march came from black artists, you know, Bernice Reagan, who was a good friend of mine, who head of a group called Sweet Honey in a Rock. She was a very primary person in coming up with the music that is now internationally known, you know, the civil rights songs, etc. She's with a group, like I said, Sweet Honey in a Rock. I love this group. She's no longer with them, but she was the leader of that group for years, and I had brought them in on several occasions when I was at the Kentucky Center for the Arts. The music and the art, I think, was essential, you know, to the overall black arts, civil rights struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the rhythm. It provided all the things when you talk about that. It provided the rhythm, the soul, the motivation, you know, to keep going mm-hmm. after being treated the way they were treated.
Did you all face any discrimination in Louisville when you all first getting started?
No, I don't think we did. We being Renaissance, is that who mm-hmm. you're referring to? No, we didn't. We had a good relationship with several corporations, several individual funders, and a couple of foundations who gave us money, because our purpose was to do good things and do them through the arts. I mean, we saw that vision way back then, that one way to reach people, one way to get people in a supportive way was to bring them the arts and bring them into the arts.
Excuse me. How did your art, either, you know, visual art or music or dance, or did it engage any of the issues that were facing the African-American population at the time?
I don't think it engaged any issues directly, you know, but I think it was the kind of thing that touched the people who were involved in the demonstrations, just in the community, et cetera, you know. When you bring in kids and teaching them music and dancing and, you know, singing, all these things are very positive. Things to encourage and to undergird, you know, the movement.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of reactions did these young students, I mean, did they leave, you know, with kind of a sense of pride and of invigoration after when you all would engage with them?
Oh, yeah, most definitely. So many of them who we were involved with have gone on to become instructors and teachers and motivators amongst a younger set of people, you know? God, there were people, names, Harlena Chern, who's came through this and was exposed to this. Blaine Hudson's wife, Bonnie, was one of the dancers in there, you know? And Mama Ya, who is involved in programming with communities and young people today, they all kind of came through the Renaissance, you know? They all kind of came through that. So we grabbed them when they were young. They in turn have grabbed another set of young people. And it's moving on, and that's the way it grows, you know? So mm-hmm. we were very instrumental in providing motivation, inspiration, and the carrying on of communicating with the younger generation.
And how aware were you of this national black arts movement and this kind of call to promote black arts as a form of
we were aware that it existed. I'm not sure how connected we felt here in Louisville to the national movement, but we knew that generally the arts were a very key ingredient in the struggle, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So wherever there's a civil rights struggle, you knew there was a black arts involvement some kind of way. And when you say black arts, I don't want to say it as if it's something that's very aloof, because black arts takes place in black communities on the street, whether it's boogieing or dancing or doo-wopping or whatever that is. That's a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, songs have been written to inspire people through the struggles, and that goes back to slavery, you know. So it's not the, I mean, the same old slave songs, but it has a different delivery, but with pretty much the same meaning. Keeping going, keeping strong, working through, making do, you know, this kind of thing.
And how important do you think this this culture that came out of, you know, or that informed Black arts, how important was that to the African American community, especially in such tumultuous times?
Extremely important, you know. I think a lot of people don't see, have not distinguished between Black arts and the civil rights struggle. You know, because I think they were kind of they worked very cogently together, you know, in a supportive role, in an active role. When you get Black artists, you know, you have Harry Belafonte, or you have Odetta, or, you know, these are all Black artists singing and marching and being a part of the whole thing too. There's that fusion that you see, because the music, the art, comes with the struggle, you know. So it becomes, it became one, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Were you active at all in the civil rights movement or the Black freedom struggle? Were you, or would you consider yourself an activist at times?
At times, yeah. Early on here in Louisville, I think this was in 1955, 56. I was coming out of high school. I think it was my senior year in high school. Lyman T. Johnson, who was the professor here, who taught at Central High School, taught me and taught just about every other Black person coming out of high school during that time. I know he organized a sit-in down at on 4th Street in one of the Macquarie store shops. So we went down and sit on the, you know, sit there to block people from getting seats, basically, to sit in, because we weren't able to go in lawfully to do that, you know. So as early as that, I was involved in the struggle. Now, ironically, I left Louisville and went to college outside of Louisville. And I think that was a year where it really geared up. So the youngsters, about a year or so younger than I, were very much more involved. You know, people like Raul Cunningham, Bill Gatewood, and many, many others were really on the front line there. But I was away at college doing my thing up there, doing that year, yeah.
Did you engage in any arts while you were away at college, or even, and when I say away, I mean throughout all your college years, even when you were studying at Bellarmine?
I was doing some singing. I joined a fraternity. We had one heck of a good group. Me and my brother were in the same fraternity. So we were the crux to the music in that fraternity, you know, but did not really get involved. I was just kind of feeling my way. I didn't know whether I wanted to be a psychologist or what, you know. In that first year, you don't, just struggling to find out which way I'm going, you know, this kind mm-hmm. of thing. But, you know, continued on afterwards and got more involved in the arts.
And did your role as an activist, both early on and some later, did that inform your art and how you approached it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I knew what I liked. I knew what, I was in a position, I think my view of the arts was expanded, you know, through the experiences that I had. You know, I sang classical music. I sang, of course, the doo-wop, the corner doo-wop. And I saw the dance, you know, and I saw the music coming together. So I was inspired and motivated by what was around me, but also had a vision of what was ahead, what, you know, to expose young people to different forms of the arts, I think, was very key in my development.
Earlier you said that you all, when you were younger, you would sing, you know, Negro spirituals or other you know, other songs or anything like that, how were they and other black artists received by white audiences at the time? And did you see that shift or change throughout the years?
I'm not sure that I performed in front of white audiences. It was during segregation, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, mainly I'm talking about black churches and black community centers and, you know, the black communities where I was pretty active, as opposed to being, you know, it was 1956, 55 and when I was in high school.
Okay. And when you first, with Renaissance, and when you first started to perform these, the black arts, how was that received by white audiences?
Oh, it was well received by those who it was exposed to. But the focus was on the black community. The focus was on taking the music to the black community, taking the arts, giving them the motivation to continue to grow and achieve, you know, and to motivate them further. You know, little girl taking dance lessons, you know, to give her some more motivation to become more than she may have been able to envision she could be.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen, how would you say Louisville's arts and Louisville's black art and black culture, how did you see it comparing to other cities? Did you visit any other cities and see anything that you could compare?
Well, when you look at the bigger cities particularly, you know, if you're talking New York, LA, San Francisco, Chicago, we weren't there. We weren't comparing, you know, but there were people here who knew where we needed to go, you know, and it just took more time to develop that. You said you talked to Bob Douglas, and I know he was involved, along with myself and a few other people, in putting together the first African American Heritage Weekend. First couple of years we worked together on that. There was a group called the West End Players or the West Side Players, one or the other, which was run by a white guy, a guy named Carl Shemp, but it was down in the West End, out of the Shawnee area. And we used to work with him to put on performances with his group of folk, you know. So I think, you know, all of those things kind of came together to really motivate others to continue onward, to look ahead and see the value of arts in our daily lives. I think that was a key result.
Who were some of the most influential people that you interacted with, and as far as Louisville's art scene or Louisville's black art scene as a whole?
Oh, your visual arts, you know, it's easy. You got to go with G.C. Cox. There was Bob Douglas, Ian Hamilton, Sam Gilliam, who came here. I don't know if he went to high school here, but he was here during that period. And he, you know, Bob, Sam is a very famous artist now, a guy named Ken Young. These were the leaders in the visual arts community, you know. The performing arts, we didn't really have a lot of strong leaders in the performing arts at that time, I think. But there were people who had the dance programs over here, theater programs over there, you know what I mean? Then we got into theater with Priscilla Hancock and, I don't want to leave her name out. God, I can't think of her name right now. They formed a theater program that was, for 1 or 2 years, was doing their theater down at the Brown Hotel, Brown Theater. It was called Macaulay at that time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was very strong, you know, and what they presented was African-American theater, you know, still, you know, holding on to what we as a people have produced. And thank goodness I see Actors Theater presenting works by African-American playwrights today, and that's kind of like a thing that I want to make sure continues, yeah.
How have you continued through the years in Louisville's art scene? I know you've stayed very active. You can just tell me a little bit about that.
Well, after after Renaissance, I was employed by the new Performing Arts Center here, Kentucky Center for the Arts, in 1983. And when they opened up, I produced the first public show that was ever presented at the Kentucky Center for the Arts. It was a gospel extravaganza. It happened, I think, the second day that the center was open. I had put together groups from around the state of Kentucky, along with a few local groups here. And I brought in a big name, so we did that on a Sunday, and it was blasted. We had a great turnout. And what my mission, as I have defined it at the Kentucky Center, I needed to get African Americans in those seats. You know, I needed to bring, and I had to do that through programming. So I'm the programmer. I'm one of the programmers there, you know. My mission was to bring in, initially, African Americans, and later on it expanded to more multiracial audiences, et cetera. But we were successful at that, and brought in the people that we wanted to bring in, et cetera. So then I started a series there. It's in 1985. I started the Midnight Ramble series.
What was that again?
The Midnight Ramble series.
Midnight.
Now, dig this. The Midnight Ramble series originally started over on Walnut Street at one of the theaters. It was the Lyric Theater. I think it was first the Lincoln Theater, and then it moved to the Lyric Theater. And I had the privilege, when I was young enough, when I was young, to attend some of those events. I would go in the daytime with my brother and some of my other friends. I went to the theater, and we'd go in and see two main movies, feature movies. We'd see cartoons. We'd see the news of the day. And then they come out with this live stage show, you know, and they call it the Midnight Ramble. And it was actual performers during the day with the young people in the audience. But it was comedians, exotic dancers, quartets, individual singers that were part of this thing called the Chitlin Circuit that would go into different black communities around the country, particularly in the South, you know, performing in segregated halls, you know, because there was no integration going on at that time. That became known as the Midnight Ramble. At midnight, they would open it up for the adults, and it got a little bit more raunchier. That's what I'm told. But I started that series at the Center for the Arts, and it is still continuous. It's the only series that is still continuing. Now, it's changed a lot. It doesn't have the same flow that I created, but nonetheless, they maintain the name, and they do things, you know. Another thing that I did at this center was the Arts Reach program, which is an educational program. It's been unbelievably successful, you know. One summer, we were kind of slow, and I said, well, we got to do something. So I called a couple of musician friends that I knew, one from New York particularly, another from Detroit. They came in, spent the summer with me, and we put together this going around the different communities. It was jazz, you know, getting people interested in jazz, et cetera. And we encountered some problems with folks who were working in the community centers who weren't attuned themselves to music or to arts. And I thought it was pretty successful, but we did acknowledge some difficulties there. Great thing about it, we got together after that run and said, well, what do we do? What's what we need to do to make this thing change? And we came up with the fact that many of the people who worked at these community centers, they were as ignorant as the children about arts and history and that type of thing, you know? So we started the program to begin to expose and train those people who worked in the community centers, you know? And that's how Arts Reach began. And they got so excited about it, they would come to the meetings and we would we would take artists, I'd bring artists in to put on the stages. I'd take them to Cabbage Patch. I'd take them to Parkland. You know, I'd just take them around the community. And that caught on to the extent that it became not only a successful local program with the Kentucky Center, but it went statewide.
Wow.
Statewide. And that's, you know, one of my legacies at the center is starting that program there.
And you're still there, correct?
No, I don't.
Oh, you're not?
No, I've been away for about 8 years.
Oh, okay.
At least 8 years. I was there for 23 years. I was one of the first staff people hired in the program department. But I have great and fond memories of the center. I love that place. And
sounds like it.
Yeah, yeah. It was home to me.
You know,
my name's Ken Clay, and they gave me the going away party. They had renamed the center to KC. Ken Clay, like I said, just facetiously, I'm sure.
You briefly mentioned Walnut Street, and that. Could you tell me a little bit more about the culture that existed in Walnut Street in the Louisville's West End?
Well, Walnut Street, the Black Walnut Street ran from 6th to about 13th Street. It's now Muhammad Ali Boulevard, but it ran from 6th to 13th Street. It was full of all kinds of businesses. There were insurance, there were three insurance companies, there were two African American banks. There were all kinds of other businesses and restaurants and entertainment spots on Walnut Street. Yeah, and it was the place to be for Louisville's Black community. All the property there was not owned by Blacks, but most of it was managed, it seemed, by Blacks, you know. But it became known as the entertainment strip, you know, for Louisville. And if you went on Warner Street Friday or Saturday night, I mean, there'd be music everywhere coming out of the clubs, you know, there's people on the street walking, etc. At Derby time, man, you know. At Derby time, it was like called Cadillac Row, because you see all the people who came in for Derby. They'd be riding up and down Warner Street, going into the clubs, dressed to the nines, and just having fun, you know. Frankie Maxwell, who was a manager of the big club there, the biggest club, called Top Hat. When I say big, I don't mean in size, but it was just the number one spot. You know, she was always at the door and greeting people, making sure no kids came in. You had to be up to a certain age and stuff like that. I was fortunate enough to know Frankie when I put together the Midnight Rambler series at the Kentucky Center, had her involved in on the committee. And she has done a recording too out here in University of Louisville. I have a copy of it. It's a little something wrong with the recording, so you can't hear everything, you know. But that was the era of Black business, etc. there. Now, Warner Street not only was, although it was known primarily for entertainment, etc., but it also had a lot of other things going for it. It was the Mecca of Black Louisville. You know, no matter where you were, if you were Black in Louisville, you knew about Warner Street, and Warner Street kind of beckoned you in some way, you know. There were a lot of business deals went down on Warner Street, you know. There were a lot of, there were doctors, accountants, and dentists. Their offices were on Warner Street. So it was the place to come, even if you needed to go to the dentist. More than likely, your dentist was located on Warner Street. Your doctor was in one of those buildings up on Warner Street. It was just a fantastic era, you know, and I call it an era. As a place and an era, but it was a period of time when Black people felt empowered here in Louisville, you know, and a lot of political things went down on Warner Street that affected the entire community, you know. It gave us hope, and it gave us a sense of ownership, you know, and it did a lot of things. When it went under, when urban renewal came through here, it just killed everything. It not only tore the buildings down, you know. It just separated the people. People who used to come together every weekend, the people who worked on Water Street, people who communicated regular, people, you know, boom, they were gone. There was no place for them to gather. They were scattered in different locations in the community. So I think that was probably the greatest harm that urban renewal did. In addition, I think it came in and just tore buildings down without a plan. I mean, just, they left a few buildings, but they didn't, I didn't see the planning of it, because it tore down some magnificent structures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was some that needed to be torn down in the alleys and so forth. It didn't have indoor toilets and things like that back in that day. But I think the government could have been more organized in terms of what it was tearing down, rather than say, we're just going to cut this block out, you know. And that's what, in fact, happened. So,
where did the black culture really go after urban renewal? Where did they go to? Where did the cultural center end up?
If I had to pick a spot, I would say down around 28th and Greenwood. I opened up at 28th and Greenwood in 67, a thing I call the Corner of Jazz. And it was like a place where people could come and gather. I got this idea from a friend of mine who moved to Chicago. He was from Louisville, and I went to visit him. You know, there's a real beginning of a real appreciation for Africa, you know. So what we had in the Corner of Jazz were African clothing, furnishings, but I had jazz music, had African-American books, you know, and we had all kinds of things that would be attractive to people whose heads were now set in appreciation of Africa and black culture here, you know. So I would have music, for example, had a friend that I had worked with. Incidentally, at that time I was working with the Community Action Agency, which was the War on Poverty, you know. And I had a friend that I had met through that, whose father owned a record distributing company in New York. And all my music came through them, you know. And man, what a variety of music, particularly the jazz music, that nobody in Louisville was selling. Nobody was selling, you know. And it was just off the hook. I used to have guys come in, it's guys and women. They'd come in, they'd buy a record, they'd buy a book, and they would come back to discuss it. You know, so it became more than just a retail outlet. It became a place, you know, synergy. A lot of the young Turks, as I call them, Dr. Blaine Hudson, incidentally, was one of those young Turks that used to come in my building, in my business, and buy and discuss. And, you know, it was a place where you could come and talk to people about the movement, you knew what the Panthers were doing, you would talk about all the things that were going on in Black America, you know, stuff like that. And then that fateful day, of course, when they had the riot, well, we call it the riot, I was there inside. When the riot went down, I was with my lady who became my wife. We were boyfriend and girlfriend at that time. She was working and running things just perfectly. People were coming into the store. It was fantastic, you know, because they had this demonstration outside. These people were going to be speaking and everything, you know. So, man, there were people who had never been to that corner, you know, came in. So this was a big business day for me, you know. And they came naturally right into my shop. They were buying all kinds of things. We were selling out of stuff, you know what I mean? And everything was perfect until that time things happened. All the speakers had just about finished. And they were actually going away. I mean, going home, getting out of the area. So, and that's when a policeman drove through the crowd. Just didn't make any sense at all. Now, what had happened, there was a young man, he was up my, on top of my roof, and I knew him because he lived in Connor Homes. This is where I was living at the time. And I knew his mother, and, you know, but he was on the roof, and I'm sure, I didn't see him do it, but I'm sure this little boy named Jimmy was the one that threw a bottle off the roof and made that pow noise. And that's when the police, you know, it was interesting. Unfortunately, after that went down, oh, that night, after things had kind of slowed down that night, Chief Hyde, who was a police, head of the police corps, he came in by himself, you know, by himself, and came in, and I pulled him in the back row because I didn't want, you know, anything to happen to him. He's down in my building, you know. We talked, et cetera, and he was so bothered by the fact that something happened because he had a great relationship. He had a great relationship with a lot of people, leaders in the black community, you know. But, you know, he came in and we talked and things went on. But next day they brought in the state the troopers and county troopers. And it was frozen down there, you know. Yeah, I almost got shot. The next day I came over to see, just to check on my place, because there was some, you know, some worry about people breaking into buildings. And that did happen, you know, a riot kind of thing. It happened further down on Dumanil than it did on Greenwood. But there were some young Turks who told me, he said, Ken, you don't have to worry about anything. We're going to stand here. We're going to protect this place. This is ours. This is what they say, you know. And they stood there, et cetera. And I don't know if I have pictures of this or not, but they, man, they, with the National Guard were there with their guns and their little knives and their guns. And I saw these young guys talking to them in their face and touching their guns and everything, and the National Guards were just, they couldn't move. And there was a brother in the National Guard, and tears were just coming down his eyes. You know, he hated to be there, you know, but that's the way it is. Wow. It was interesting. It was interesting.
was there a lot of damage done to the corner jazz?
No damage done to the corner jazz. No siree, no damage. Nobody touched the corner jazz. Earlier, before the riots, the only incident we had down there, one morning we came to work and somebody had come in the back where the air conditioning unit was. They took the air conditioner out of the wall and came in and stole some stuff. But you know, an ironic thing happened. We put out the word as people came in that we'd been robbed, et cetera, et cetera. And things began to reappear. They would bring back the albums that they had bought, they had stolen, some books, you know, some things. Began to come back. So, and that, I think, is a testament to the significance that that building, that business was to that community, to the people who came in there and said, oh my God, I'm going out here, I'm going to find stuff. I see people today, I know, was one of the robbers, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I see them today, and I say, hey, what's going on? They don't know I know, you know. But it was amazing. I think that community really responded in a very positive way to see that we got our stuff back and we continued on, you know. But after the riots, man, there was no business at all. It was a ghost town. Nobody came in on 28th Greenwood Street. And if you go down there today, it hasn't improved that much at all, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Corner of Jazz was kind of a place for black intellectuals to meet and join in this conversation of, you know, national struggle. And you know, really, I know from readings and things that was one of the things that was promoted throughout the black freedom struggle, that this, you had to create this kind of intellectual group to, you know, I mean, people wanted to educate themselves and, you know, African-American culture and everything. Well, where did, was there a place where people met after the uprising? If the Corner of Jazz wasn't there, where did people go to kind of discuss these issues in there?
I don't think there was a place, you know, where everybody said, well, let's go here now and begin to talk, you know. There might, if there was a place, if maybe a place like a Joe's Palm Room, which was over on Jefferson Street, or Broadway at the time, Jefferson Street. But it didn't have the same kind of environment, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. People might have gotten together to talk about certain things. But they couldn't do it in the midst of all the African music and intellectual and educational things. The motivational kind of environment, I think, that was present at the Corner of Jazz, I don't think that existed too many places. In addition, it was after the demise of Walnut Street. So, you know, there weren't a whole lot of places people really kind of gathered. Because it used to be before that, there were places on Warner Street and Chester Street that, there used to be a place right across from Chester Street, YMCA, that I know a lot of artists used to gather. You know, we'd bring our books, we'd bring our paintings, and we'd just sit and talk and exchange and socialize. But
was that the Brown Derby?
Brown Derby, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Douglas.
Yeah, he'd be involved in that.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever participate in visual arts at all? I don't know if I touched
on that. Not as a visual artist, only as a promoter, producer, someone who loved it, mm-hmm. purchased it, and, you know.
One thing I've noticed is that there's kind of a difference when speaking of visual arts and performing arts as well of black artists who kind of were creating and promoting kind of the African American culture as opposed to other people who were kind of more Afrocentric with their art and focusing on African heritage. Did you see a lot of that overlap throughout both visual arts and performance arts?
Oh yeah, you know. I think because of the movement, the times, people reflected in their work what was going on in society, you know? And during the I think you saw during the period of the civil rights and struggle, and particularly the you know, you talk about people like Stokely, Malcolm, Ralph Brown, etc., you know, it was a different kind of thing that was going on as opposed to what Martin Luther King was doing. You know, it was more aggressive or more, you know, in your face kind of things that began. Art began to take on a different. Some art began to take on that kind of, you know, feeling. I'm trying to get it out. Whereas with and there was this division of divisiveness, maybe that's not the right word, but there was a more moderate approach to the civil rights struggle, and then there was a more aggressive approach, you know. When I opened the Corner of Jazz, before it opened, and people were scared to death, I had large posters of people like, I had Ralph Brown, I had Stokely Carmichael, I had Malcolm X, and Muhammad Ali. And when you rode down 28th Street, all you saw in those windows was these pictures. So folks didn't know what was getting ready to happen in there, you know? It scared people to death, you know? So of course, that, I'm sure we were, the police were aware, became aware that this may be a place where something might happen, you know? But on the contrary, when we opened up, we were welcoming the community. The University of Louisville, I can't think of his name, had a professor here at the time who had traveled a lot, and particularly in Africa, had taken students, and he brought his students down to the Corner of Jazz on a fairly regular basis, you know, to see the African connection and just to talk with us and to the people there and expose those kids to some things that were going on. I think a lot of them really benefited from that, you know. So, you know, we were supportive of all things, not all things, but things African and African-American, you know, but we weren't opposed to anything because some of our best customers, you know, came from different ethnic backgrounds, you know.
Throughout the years, how have you seen the black arts in Louisville kind of grow, and how do you see it today? Do you think people still put a lot of emphasis? I know you said that was one of the things you focused on at the Kentucky Center was bringing in African American artists, and you know, do you still see a call in Louisville of people wanting to engage African American art?
Yeah, I think that we do, but it's not as strong as it used to be. I think there's been a merging of a love for the arts. You know, for example, I now do the World Fest for the city of Louisville, my 10th year producing and identifying all the artists, and I love it, I love it. What's going on, I think, worldwide is this merging of cultures, you know? And I love when I bring in a group that has in its membership a musician from Africa, from Asia, from Ireland, you know, just a mix, because the music is the fusion, is reflecting world togetherness, you know what I'm saying? It's bringing the different cultures together, and that's one thing about the art. And that's one thing about music that is gonna lead us out of this darkness, I think. You know, musicians get along perfectly, you know, regardless of where they come from. They can communicate, they get along wonderful. As an aside, I'm talking to a group of musicians now, putting together an exhibit on African-American musicians in Louisville. And I talked to a couple of them about what was it like between, you know, white and African-American musicians. And the guy said, we never had a problem. We always talk. You know, this is white and black. And they're great friends, man, you know, great friends. And so, you know, it may take that kind of thing to bring people together more, you know, mm-hmm. the understanding of one another's culture. An appreciation for.
I agree, and I think that's kind of all the questions I had.